Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, drama, LGBT, thriller.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Riverside.
And 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, and that's Mr. David North Martino.
It is I, Al.
It's
my full name again.
Yeah, it's the end of the polite week. Remember that? Oh. This is for the Friday show, so it's over. And next week
is going to be tough.
Two whips. Double whip.
Double whips.
It's wax on, wax off.
Exactly.
You know? And speaking of whacking, I still can't help talking about the Gwyneth Paltrow thing, you know? And not the thing is, her lawsuit, I mean, it's probably BS and I don't care. But just that website and the goop and all that stuff, my God. I couldn't believe it.
You got to get one of those candles.
Oh, yeah, they sold out, yeah.
Oh.
So, but they have the vaginal insert balls, you know, those granite things that you can stick up. And I was thinking of maybe getting one of those, but they sold out.
Don't they have the roll-on still?
Well, yeah, but, you know, roll-ons, you know, come on.
Yeah.
I don't even like roll-on. So it's just, what am I going to do with that? Anyway, I'm disappointed. So she's stuck in court dealing with this instead of making new candles. And the ozone machine is great. I've had that up my butt now for 3 weeks, and I've never felt better.
You sound like you're feeling better.
Getting there, I tell you. It cures everything, you know, like that other guy said.
Yeah.
It cures everything. Cures
everything.
Cancer. Why haven't we been doing this? My God, you know. Well, now speaking of Goop and Gwyneth Paltrow, we're going right into horror, and I'm supposed to laugh. That's a segue. You're slow. Yeah. Okay, so now today we've got a horror writer, and he's written a book. He's written a few books, it looks like. We're going to get into the mind of Mr. Michael Clark. So thank you for being here.
Well, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, hopefully at the end of the show you say that.
Well, I won't say it out loud if I'm not happy.
So Hell on High is the new book. It's got an interesting name. It's got a great look to it and all that. Let's talk a little bit about that. How did it come about?
It came about with my fascination for Mount Everest and the way if you climb the mountain and you die up there, they're going to leave you. It's just, it's too difficult to get you down. And some of these bodies over the years became landmarks. So there was, you know, everybody that summited from the south side of the mountain would crawl past Green Boots, as he was known. And just the picture of him, I think he's missing now. Somebody threw him off the mountain or something. But he was up there for about 10 years. And, you know, he's frozen. His coat is you know, fraying in the weather and fading in the sun. And he's hard as a rock. And the snow is just, like, blowing over him. Like, it looks, like, you know, better than any kind of a Hollywood movie could decorate a set. He's just part of the mountain. And I wanted to kind of capture that in the pages. So that's what I started with. My wife is Brazilian, so my her cousin said, "Hey, you should. There's a lot of black magic in northern Brazil, and it's called Macumba. So you should start there." And I'm thinking, yeah, I didn't want to, you know, write about voodoo because I don't know anything about that really, and I know more about Brazil than I know about New Orleans, and I didn't want to go to Salem, Massachusetts, because they weren't really, you know, witches there, and even though I used to live in Salem. So I kind of put the two together, and what it is in the end, is it's an adventure. It's a couple of adventures. I have a heroine. Her name is Juliana. She starts in Brazil. She's forced to leave because something terrible happens. She leaves her sister behind, her little girl, and then she starts working in the United States to rescue her. And in the meantime, she meets a mountain climbing guy. She has learned that she has a talent for hiking and mountain climbing, and he's got some connections. And the story takes place in the 70s, and it turns out that she could become the first woman to summit Mount Everest. So we're in three continents with this one, and it's all over the place. My previous story was a haunted house, so it was quite a different experience.
Yeah, sounds like it. It's cool, but when you did this, when you were thinking about that, did you do research in that area of climbing Mount Everest and the people that have died there and stuff, some of their history?
Oh, yeah.
You did, eh?
Yeah, I mean, it's I wish I could say I traveled to Mount Everest and, you know, really did a deep dive, but no, I didn't. I did, like what probably most of us do, first of all, I already had a fascination with Everest. I've read Into Thin Air a couple of times. I've read Sir Edmund Hillary's book. I love, you know, all the little specials and YouTube videos. So I already had a fascination, and then I just did a deeper dive. There are a lot of people, a lot of amateurs that film themselves just walking to base camp. And I watched like three or four of those, and these are people that are, you know, they start off laughing and having fun, and then they get closer to base camp and it's freezing and they start getting headaches and, you know, maybe food poisoning, something like that. And it's hell on earth, and they're only at 17,000 feet at base camp. But 17,000 feet is also the highest point in the Alps, so there's no messing around up there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy, you know. Or you could have gone up there and just and died and then used that as the...
Some do. You know? A lot of people do. Like now there's like 300, you know, deaths up there. And most of them are up there, although I've heard that they're starting to clean them up, especially on the Tibetan side. The Chinese are, you know, getting rid of the landmarks. And, you know, and then I also heard recently that they're starting to do that on the Pali side, and it costs between $40,000 and $80,000 to get one body down.
Wow. Wow. No wonder they have to move.
No messing around. But in the 70s, like, they nobody came down. It was, you die up there, you're staying.
Right. Well, couldn't they send Wonder Woman up there? Or?
Well, she doesn't have a coat, you know, so she would need to cover up.
When those people go up there and they die up there, do they not have any family or relatives that will pay to bring them down, or they just didn't? Like, why is there so many? Yeah.
Do you have Hulu? I mean, there's one on Hulu that's brand new, and it's like got the most modern, you know, camera equipment and everything. I mean, it's just beautiful. I mean, if you want to get a real sense of, not like I've been there, but
yeah,
it's the best sense of what it's like to climb through the Khumbu Icefall and see how big these things are that could fall on you, or just how big the valley is. And it's really captured well. And this guy, he's up there looking for his dead brother, and he leaves his beautiful wife and two young kids behind to do it. You know, for just to find a body. I mean, you could be another body.
Yeah,
is you know, it's just it's nuts. It's and a lot of these guys are, you know, family men, and it's just they're driven. You know, they're driven to climb this stupid mountain. And they risk everything to do it. And there's so many stories, and it's most of it's on YouTube. Just people that, you know, got lost overnight. They have to bivouac, no tent, you know, overnight. And then somehow this guy survives, and he's it's just nuts. It fascinates me. I can't believe people do it.
Yeah, neither can I. But, you know, every day that you're alive over the years, you start to see how unusual a lot of people are in this world that we're living with. So, in a way, I'm not so surprised, but it's kind of crazy. How do you get into the mindset of these characters? Like for instance, Juliana, the 19-year-old Brazilian. How can you get in the mindset of someone like that enough that you can write their character and dialogue?
That's a good point. A good question. Well, I think I pictured my wife as her. You know, I pictured her being younger. So you kind of have like a, you know, a model for. I borrowed the one of the names from my cousin, and you know, so I've been to Brazil. I've spent about a year of my life there, on and off. You know, I can speak Portuguese like a baby. I use somebody as a base for the character, and you know, I know some of the basic words, and I just go from there. It's easy when you can picture the person.
How do you write the character that, you know, the person that's died on the mountain? How do you cover that kind of a person?
In this book, we don't really cover a corpse that's already there, although they do pass them on their way up the mountain. And without getting into spoilers, you'll get to know somebody before they die on the mountain. So the character is alive and breathing and, you know, already kind of fleshed out, so to speak. And then, you know, something happens.
Well, did you find when you were doing your research, what drives people to climb Mount Everest?
I'm still shaking my head. I mean, it's just watch one of these base camp videos, you know, like, it looks like it's going to be fun, and everybody's bumming by the time they get up there, you know? It's just like, why would I want to spend, you know, not only all the money to get over there, but you know, then you're going to get sick, basically, or you just really have a bad, bad time, or at least freeze to death. They're staying in basically plywood boxes. That's the tea house rooms. It's just the worst of the worst. And, you know, crapping in a hole, you know? So it doesn't sound fun at all, except for, you know, hey, I did it,
wow.
You know, that kind of a thing. And then, you know, people just go the rest of the way up the mountain just because it's there. And that's a famous quote from Hillary.
When you're putting this together, I something I always ask is, so do you start with the characters? Do you start with the story? Or do you start with the setting? And it seems like all three have their important parts to the story. And it sounds like you kind of had the idea. How do you typically write a book?
From a scene, you know, from or the, you know, the one thing that I want definitely to be in the book, like in this case, you know, the dead bodies on Everest. You know, some people go missing. Mallory, they found him a while back, but his climbing partner, Sandy Irvin, is still missing. You know, they just can't find a lot of these people. Yeah, I start with a scene or a couple of things, and then I build around it. You know, I obviously Brazil was another part of it that I had to connect the two. And it's not really like, I'd say that the Everest part of the book is about a third of it. There's a lot of, the first part is about Brazil. The second part is being in the United States. It like I said, it's an adventure, and they've got to get from point A to point B, and there's a lot of setup. But in a haunted house, there could be something around any corner. In this one, that tension of a haunted house is not there, but the adventure of it is. Like, first of all, the immigration part was also taken from YouTube and real life illegal immigration, people crossing borders. They have to, if you start in Brazil, you've got to cross 11 borders. And the worst part of that adventure or journey is a jungle in the border of Colombia and Panama. Not only does it have jaguars and crocodiles and, you know, every insect known to man and snake, but there's also a drug-running, guerrilla army in there that will kill you for no reason. And this is real. And you could watch any one of these videos on YouTube, too. And it's just real-life people that are so desperate. Like, they fly, nowadays, they fly from all over the world to Brazil because it doesn't have, like, a lot of visa requirements, and they come up through. So we're not just getting Mexicans over our border, you know, and I'm sympathetic to these people that are so desperate that they have to do that. We're getting people from all over the world. There's a, in the video, there's a, you know, it's called, I think it's called CBS something. And the name of the jungle is the Darien Gap, if you want to look it up. But the guys from Iran, they fly from all over the world to come here and find a better life. And it's really sad, and it's really, really dangerous.
It sort of sounds like Texas, you know.
Well, I have them coming up through Arizona, but it, the thing that you're talking about, the news this week.
Yeah.
Well, my son was recently stationed in El Paso, and he used to look across, you know, I haven't asked him yet, but he could see one of those camps. I don't know if it was on the El Paso side or on the Mexican side, but. You know, he could see one right out of his window, and that's where it happened. Like, I think it was in Mexico, but I don't know if that was the one he could see or not. But, yeah, it's exactly like that. And one thing I did do, I was invited to a wedding down in Puerto Penasco, Mexico, and we had to fly to Phoenix and drive down through the Arizona desert and through this town called Sonoita, Mexico, and then drive all the way straight through Mexico, which I was nervous about. Because I've heard it can be a little bit nerve-wracking. And it's like a beach resort, and then when you get there, you're okay. So I was able to see that part of the land and where people really do sneak over and what it's like. And I'll tell you, it's big. That desert is big. And God bless anybody that has to do that.
Yeah, it's crazy. It sounds like, okay, so this is a horror and an adventure, I guess a thriller in the same time. Did you write this completely out of, for entertainment purposes, for a story? Or is there something more to this? Do you have some...
Like social commentary?
Well, it doesn't have to be social commentary. It could just be some meaning, and it may be a meaning for yourself or to you. Like sometimes people write a story and it means something to them. It might not necessarily mean the same thing to the reader, and plus things develop, like, you know, commentaries, or you might say a subtext, but that sometimes happens organically, like it wasn't intended, but just it came out of the story. So do you think, is there something like that attached to this?
Not really commentary, except I do write, you know, something about, you know, why did I choose Brazil, because I don't know if you heard about the controversy of the book American Dirt, written by a woman, like a white woman that says she was married to an immigrant. It was picked by Oprah Winfrey to be her, you know, in her, her choice of the month or however she does it. And then, you know, she was chastised, not so much Oprah, but the author, because she does a lot of commentary about Mexico and, opinions. And she talks a little bit about skin color. And then it turns out that her husband is like an Irish immigrant. So it really didn't, like the people of Mexico and Latinos in general kind of came down on her hard. And that happened while I was writing this. So I was like, oh God, you know, like I'm a gringo. My wife calls me a gringo. And, here I am writing this book and I'm, you know, neck deep in it already. So, you know, I really went back and looked and took out any kind of, I don't think I had much commentary. I just wanted to start it in Brazil because I know more about Brazil than, like I said, there's black magic there. Okay. And I don't know anything about voodoo or Santeria or any other kind of black magic. So, but I've been to Brazil and I've seen these, offerings left at crossroads, and I've been to the beach on New Year's Eve and I see, you know, people practicing Macumba and throwing white flowers into the ocean for Yimanja, the goddess of the sea. And it's a real thing. And we have a friend here, a Brazilian friend that lives in Massachusetts here too. And she helped me, with the Macumba part of the book. She practices it, the white magic part. So her name was, Janich. No, as far as like, I wanted this to be fun. I wanted it to be a fun book. It's not really a, you know, any kind of a social commentary, but it's as real as I could get it. I tried to get the atmosphere of the immigration part, the atmosphere of the Everest part. You know, I haven't even mentioned why she had to flee Brazil, but it's got something to do with black magic. And, you know, there's some, supernatural, entities, in the book as well. And I know it sounds like it's all over the place, but it is an adventure. I think it's unique and it's something that you haven't read before. And I do believe that it's a little bit better put together than what I might be making it sound like right now.
No, no, it sounds fine. It's how did you get into writing this book? Like, what led you to this idea? Was there a particular incident or something you saw?
Yeah, I had a dream that my wife was frozen solid. I used to work in a seafood restaurant, and we used to get this frozen swordfish, right? Like a whole swordfish, except for the head. And it's, you know, it's like a 80-pound baseball bat, you know? It's hard as a rock. And I had a dream that she was frozen solid like that, and I had to pick her up, and she wouldn't move. And I've seen a couple of videos on YouTube of, you know, removing a dead body, and they are just like, they look like, you know, you're pulling a shrimp out of the freezer, you know? They're just stuck in that one, in the exact position they died. So I did have a dream about that. I'm like, yeah, you know, and I've always had this fascination with the dead bodies that don't move up there. And then, you know, just married it to the Brazil part. And
yeah.
And then if I'm going to write something supernatural, I really like ghosts and I like witches or black magic kind of a thing. I'm not so much into demons or, you know, stuff like that. I do like serial killers too. I saw you did a bunch of stuff on serial killers.
Yeah.
But I have yet to write a novel about them. One is in the works. I'm halfway into another novel now, and I was inspired by I'll Be Gone in the Dark. I always have this eternal fascination, like, why? And I can't wrap my head around it. Do you feel like you've gotten closer to that?
No, I've gotten to realize that there is no difference. Usually when you meet a killer, if you didn't know they were a killer, you probably wouldn't know it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're so, usually the real serial killers, the majority of who is involved in that kind of world, is a very average person that you would have no idea was the killer. It's kind of, I don't know if it's glorified or made something spectacular, but most serial killers are not Hannibal Lecter, so to speak.
Mm.
They're not like this well-educated, well-traveled, and you know, they can tell you all the fine wines and all. They're usually not that type of a person. They're just they're Joe Blow down the road.
That's what everybody says. I would have known he was so normal, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's the true. And when you meet them, that's generally what you find. How did you get involved in writing, period? Like what? Because you aren't a lifelong writer, right? You didn't start this when you were six and just...
No, I'm older than most of the writers, I think. I'm 57. And, you know, started at like 52. And I think I was just sick of seeing reboots in movie theaters. You know, like if I could direct a movie, I would, but I know it takes, you know, millions of dollars and million, you know, tons of people. And the learning curve is just too much. So I figured if I could write a story, it only takes me to do that. And then, you know, maybe it'd be picked up someday, like Paul Tremblay's, you know, the Cabin at the End of the World. And, you know, that would be the ultimate dream. You know, I know the odds are against that. And so it was, it was born out of, like, why are they rebooting Pet Sematary? You know, it's like it's almost the same movie. And you know, Batman, why do we, you know, have to see some? I love Batman, but they're ruining it, you know. It's, give him a break and maybe come up with a new character or something like that. I don't know, but... You know, they're so worried about their money and you know, they need to go with something tried and true. And if you want to break through with something new, you really got to, you know, I don't know how to do it. I haven't done it yet, but that's the goal, you know, to somehow break through and you know, elbow my way into, you know, the public entertainment sector. I don't know.
You're going to start sleeping with people.
Oh.
It works. It works.
Well, I do sleep with my wife.
No, but you've got to get out there and get into Hollywood and start.
Honey, I'll be right back.
That's right. No, it's a tough business, and you never know. There's no answers to it. There's no answers. You just got to focus on what you do.
Yeah.
The more you can focus on your writing and not so much on the noise around you, I think the better you become and the better at it you become. Because there's so many distractions, and the more popular you get, the more distractions there are. And that's what you've got to learn to avoid. It's quite a balancing act, but before you know it, you'll be Stephen King. Hey, you know, he's got a couple of books out, and I think he's got a movie out. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Steve King. Yeah, I think I've heard
of him. He's hard to find, but I think you can find him in a bookstore or two.
I actually met him. I met him 40 years ago tomorrow. I have a signed copy of Christine. I was 17 years old, and I forgot it's tomorrow, but it's 3/31/83. And, I asked him, I said, what's coming up after Christine? He says, well, it's a book called Pet Cemetery, blah, blah, blah. So that's my little Stephen King story.
Yeah, you should have told him, listen, forget it, stop. You don't know what you're doing.
I should have told him that to not okay the reboot of the second movie.
Oh, you know, I think it's at a point where he doesn't care, and as a writer, it's out of your hands.
No.
When things get optioned, they option it. They have control. You have a lot less control over what they're going to do with your book, you know.
Yeah, true.
Until you become a big shot like he is now. Back then, he probably didn't have that much say, and it's a good amount of money, and you take it, and you don't worry about it, you know.
Yeah, he doesn't like Stanley Kubrick's The Shining.
Yeah.
I know that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's all kind of relevant to what you are and what you're looking for. I mean, there's so many formulas now. Like, I couldn't imagine, like, we've talked to a lot of writers that do scripts and writing for a lot of the series out there right now, and everything's formulaed. You know, they're under such pressure, and they got so much to do. They take a lot of other formulas used in other stories and kind of rework it for the new one.
That's what I'm sick of. Maybe I'll never make it, but I wouldn't be able to write that because that's, I'd be a hypocrite.
No, but if I can say, you're right. You know, in your mind, you sit there and go, oh, I couldn't do that. That's right. But when I know a lot of them, and what it is when you get in the place, they're like you. They've been working, and they've got, you know, maybe longer than you. They've been doing it since they were 30 and still haven't really made it, so to speak. And all of a sudden, they get a really good script comes along. The pay is great and the regular amount of money. So you take it.
Yeah.
Knowing that, wow, this is all of a sudden you go from making, you know, whatever to $150,000, you're like, okay, you know, you just jump.
And you can put it on your resume and keep working.
You know, I find the best thing about some of the worst things you do in your life is you meet and network with some people that end up being somewhere down the road in your life that end up helping. Like, it's probably the best thing you get out of these different side maneuvers. But it's no different than going to work for, you know, a McDonald's or a restaurant. You're just doing something to make money while you get what you really care about done. So I think I sort of allow it. But I know what you're saying, because most of the streaming stuff now, I can't stand watching most of
it. Yeah, because it's, I don't know how old you are, but you know how old I am.
60.
Okay, so we're like same generation. And we know that there's a new generation every 10, 20 years or whatever it is, and they're just going to say, hey, they haven't seen Batman yet, and they're going to, you know, kick out of Batman, and, you know, just because that generation hasn't paid to see Batman yet. So, right. Yeah, that's what we're kind of up against.
Yeah, and then they're going to have, they want their stars in it. They don't want someone that was famous back in the 80s and 90s. They want someone now, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, but it's kind of boring. I know what you're saying. I'm not really into most of them myself. I'd rather watch the original. So you know you're old when. that's what I always say. Some of them I give a try. I mean, but that, you know, that new, that movie that just won Best Picture and all those awards, you know, the Everything All Over Every Time, you know, that movie. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen that one yet, but.
No.
It's really atrocious.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
I mean, it's really not good. And the thing is, I really liked some of the people in the movie. I like some of the actors. I like some of the careers in it and stuff. But, oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I'm curious. My wife's like, no, not watching it because she's not into, you know, I guess it's a little bit of sci-fi or something. But
it's crazy, and it's a lot of karate and martial arts and stuff. Dave, didn't you give it Dave does reviews, I know. Didn't you get star or something?
Well, I gave it 3, you know. It's a very polarizing movie. Some people absolutely love it. Some people absolutely hate it. So I went for the middle, and I still got some bad emails and stuff.
Yeah, they want him to die.
Yeah, they want him to die. They said I was going to age out.
Oh.
Age out. People like me will age out. So. Yeah. I don't know.
It's
I tried to give it a
cancel.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, just okay. Yeah, he's not, you know. But it's just kind of crazy in a sense. It's let's just say I didn't mind it the first half hour, the first 45 minutes. I was okay. And then after that, it was just crazy. I had to do it in two settings. And the I want it to slit my wrists and my ears were bleeding by the end of it. So
I rarely like Oscar movies, but I'm always sucked in, like, okay, I'll try that. And like, oh, God, why did I do that? So
this is not an Oscar movie. I don't know why. I'm really surprised. Other than maybe a visual effects or some of the studio effects that they did, I couldn't imagine why it won any of those awards, personally. Again, it's an opinion. So what made you decide to actually publish a book? What was it that happened that made you publish the very first thing you did? Like, was there a reason? Did something happen and you got
it? It might have been that Pet Sematary movie. And my nephew, he's, you know, 40 years younger than me, and I think we were talking about one of the new Star Wars movies, you know, a few years back, and I'm like, well, this part was good, but that part wasn't good. And he's like, why don't you ever like any movies? And I was like, oh, God, I'm that guy, you know, and I'm the grumpy old man. And, you know, I was like, I better put up or shut up. You know, everybody was like, no, I like that. I like that. I'm like, God, you guys are so easy. Yeah. So I just feel opinionated about that kind of thing. And I had to put my money where my mouth was. And I said, what the hell? I'll do it. And so I did it and self-published. My first book is called The Patience of a Dead Man. And then I've stretched it into a trilogy. So I've really written two stories, but it's four novels. And the first one being, you know, first three being self-published. And then the latest one, I went through a small press called Bridget's Gate Press, and they've been wonderful to work with. Although now I'm finding, like, the thing about self-publishing, I guess you can, I mean, it's a lot of work, right? Especially if you go wide and you're Ingram Spark and you want your book, you know, to be sold on every, you know, in every possible place. So I did the Amazon only thing, the KDP, and that was hard enough. And, you know, all these learning curve and everything. And so I'm like, well, I want to see my book in bookstores. And so I went through Bridges Gate Press and I see on Twitter all these other authors that have done things with Bridges Gate and similar presses that, are, you know, they're getting their books in bookstores. And so I'm like, this is what I want to do, because in my day job is I'm a salesman. Like, I can get on the phone. I hate it, but I can do it. And I know, like, it used to be that somebody says no or hangs up the phone on you. I'm not a telemarketer, by the way. but I do use the telephone, and if somebody hangs up on you, it might crush you, you know, it would just, you know, you'd want to quit and stop working for the day. But I've got past that. I know it's like all about numbers and polite and let them hang up on you or whatever and take no for an answer. So I'm all ready for this. And this is kind of still unfolding. There's a Barnes & Noble employee on Twitter, he's getting all kinds of books into his store because he's ordering them. And then it seems like all of a sudden corporate is asking him, hey, why are you doing this? You know, these are all print-on-demand books, which was a new term to me. It's not, like, I guess if your books aren't printed up ahead of time, they're not as good as books that are printed to order. And so all of a sudden this is kind of like falling through, like to get into a bookstore. I was ready to call like every bookstore in America. Like, I started printing off states worth of Barnes & Nobles and indie bookstores.
Yeah.
And I had some, you know, early success with some of the ones that specialize in horror, and like five or six. And then I started running into some roadblocks and this print-on-demand thing. So this is kind of a half a thought, but I just wanted to let you know where I am right now. Like, and in my career – going from self-publishing to a small press and trying to break through to that next level kind of thing. I've only been doing it for, you know, published for 4 years. This is where I am, and this is the log jam that I face right now.
Well, I'm curious. You know, we were talking off air about the Merrimack Valley Book Festival, and I'm just curious how you found the horror community? Because I know I found it way back with like the Shock Lines message board, but I was curious to how you found it. Did you find that through the book festival, or was there some other way that you met everybody?
I don't remember. It was something like, I think I started on Facebook, and then I'm like, I should be on Twitter too, and then you know, podcasts and that kind of a thing, listening to podcasts. Yeah, I think I just found like a couple of people, like maybe Laurel Hightower. I don't know if you know her, but she's a big name. And we kind of became friends, you know, like she helped me get going. She told me what to do as far as like, there's a list of bloggers. You want to get bloggers to read your book. And so I, you know, talked to all those people and kind of like elbowed my way in a little bit gently. And so that's the way I did it. But the funny thing about the Merrimack Valley Halloween Book Festival is Christopher Golden lives in the same town I do.
Yeah.
And Haverhill Press is here too. And like,
yeah.
I never knew this. I've lived here since 2003. And, you know, just, I'm like, you know, my story is going to change the world. I'm going to write something fresh and new. And then I realized that, you know, tons of people are already doing that. I just had never heard of anybody, you know, like I just my bad, you know. But there's so many people are writing books. But, yeah, so I had the gall to call the library and say, hey, I want to get a table. Can I talk to Christopher Golden? You know, and now that I know he's New York Times bestselling Christopher Golden and all this stuff, I'm like, you know, what you don't know. Like, even though I was 52, I was acting like a dumb kid.
Yeah, but, you know, it's just one of those things. You live and learn, right? You're going through it, and that's how that you're never going to know until you do it type thing.
Yeah, you don't know what you know, and you're making mistakes, and sometimes it works out. Like, he's probably looking at me like, this guy wants a table? You know,
yeah.
So, well, but I got a table for the first time this year.
Yeah, but you don't know until you ask, right? You don't know until you get in there. And
that's it.
And start.
You got to take your swings, you know, and just don't be obnoxious.
Well, yeah, just you get in there and you just want, you know, the worst they can do, right, in really is just say no.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
You know, and if they laugh at you, then you get their name and you follow them and you hunt them down and kill them.
Yeah, he lives in my town. I'll egg his house.
Yeah. I know where you live. I know where you get your check. That's what I do. I've got a huge amount of bodies here stocked up. So now I also noticed that you did have a problem with, I guess you call it book theft in a sense, someone else selling your book and you're not really making anything of it. It's kind of like hijacking your material. I don't really want to call it
plagiarism. Piracy.
Yeah, piracy, I guess, is the best way to do it. How did that happen?
It was just, I'm still, and Bridget's Gate Press is still kind of like, what the hell happened? The book came out March 9th. Today's March 30th. So, you know, they were planning on doing that. And then they there was a pre-order up for a 99-cent ebook, and that was up since, like, mid-January. So we're pushing, you know, pre-sales and everything. And just looking for numbers. I mean, obviously we're not going to make money off 99-cent ebook, you know. But my first time with a publisher, I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna make myself more desirable to my publisher and publishers like them. Comes time for like the 8th or something, like they go to upload the paperback and then it's flagged for copyright infringement. And I'm like, and they're like, well, do you know of anything in your book that would be, you know, infringement? And so I go through the whole damn book and I'm like, well, I quoted a song here and I did the, no. And then Amazon, meanwhile, is just the worst. There's three departments. They don't talk to each other. It could have been, you know, dealt with a 10-minute phone call. If you could even call one of these departments, there's no phone number. And this is Amazon.
Right. Yeah.
And, God forbid. So it goes on for 4 days and like the book is on Amazon. It's posted on Amazon, you know, shipped by, what was it? Super Book Deals. And then another one. I forget the name of that one. There was like two shipped by or sold bys. And we're like, what the hell? I mean, they didn't even have the graphics for the back cover or the spine of the book. They just had like a picture of the front cover because that was up for the presale. So we get flagged, and then Amazon does something, and they leave I'm just going to say pirated because I don't know what happened.
Right.
Like you know, the ARCs go out, the advanced reader copies go out, and it's in Ingram. It's in what's the name of that? NetGalley.
Right.
And we send out a bunch of ARCs and stuff too. So could have been somebody, you know, one of our ARC readers or somebody from NetGalley. We don't know. And then so we complain or we get flagged, and then Amazon takes down not the entire listing from Super Book Deals, but just the cover. So now there's a listing with no cover. It says no image available. And they leave it up for 4 days. And meanwhile, we're like, what the hell? You know, I mean, it's supposed to be out March 9th, and now it's, you know, March 12th. And finally, they did whatever they did, and we're up there, and it's finally our book. Meanwhile, my neighbor had ordered the pirated version. And he's like, it's on the way. And I'm talking like March 17th.
Right.
And yeah, it should be here today. And then it gets delayed. And then it has an Amazon tracking number. It's going to be delivered by an Amazon van. Nope, didn't come today. And I said, well, just cancel it, you know. And so because I wanted to see what came in the mail. I was going to trade him, you know, a real copy for whatever this thing was with no back cover. Finally, I'm just like, just cancel it. And I think really what happened there was Amazon couldn't tell him that the book wasn't coming, and they wanted him to cancel it. That's just my best guess.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no. They're too big of an operation. They don't have enough. It's too big to control or streamline that much. But Super Book Deals are, you know, the people ripping off.
Yeah, they have terrible ratings. I looked up Yelp.
Well, 186 Trustpilot stars. Yeah, I mean, they're told they never send books. They never give you your money back. There's no service. So they're set up just to pirate copies and send them out and try to make money, I guess. But I just don't understand how that can't be shut down.
Amazon puts it on Amazon.com. You know,
well, of course, See, because it's all done digitally and they don't really pay attention. And bots are kind of scanning things, so they just sort of take the info and they let you, because if you want to sell products, you can sell it on Amazon. And so they're too big and not enough control over it, not enough.
We lost all the pre-sales too. They just canceled them all. And everybody, you know, all my friends or whoever, you know, like, hey, your book was canceled today. Oh, okay. You know, like answering all that. Side note, I was a little flattered that somebody wanted to pirate my book. So
yeah,
a little bit of ego there that was massaged.
Think about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I checked out Super Book Deals too. They've only got two of my books. So.
Oh, they do?
Yeah. But what can you do? I just don't know what you can do.
I don't know, but they're out of Maryland. I mean, it's just you'd think that Amazon would do something about it or just ban them or something. I don't know.
Yeah, and not let them use their platform, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's a whole new world. Got to learn how to use it, I guess.
Well, that's at least I don't know the old way of doing it, so I don't have to forget.
Well, the old way was just the big boys, you know, and a few small publishers. And now the independent publishers, you've got to be careful of, because a lot of them don't go broke. A lot of them don't do very much for you. A lot of them don't really do much for what they take in it, and some do, you know. So you got to.
I think they're still guarding their stuff, too. I think they're the ones that, you know, said something to Barnes & Noble. And, like, even just today, like, I chose New Jersey to start, like, this was last week. Practice my spiel. I didn't want to, like, get rejected in Massachusetts where I live. And I just, I'm going to try New Jersey. I'm going to start, you know, asking people that don't know who I am if I can send some swag with, you know, to you. If you order two of my books, I'll send some autograph stuff so that the, you know, the readers can take a print and a book plate sticker and a bookmark home, you know, and naive again, right? And so I talked to an independent bookseller with a pretty good, you know, store. He seems to be pretty busy. And then I also called at Barnes & Noble. And I called them back today because I needed like a refresher, a recap. I had follow-up questions. And so first of all, last week, the Barnes & Noble guy says that print-on-demand books are, you get no credit when you return them. That's right. What his boss told him.
Yeah.
But I call the independent guy, and he says, no, I'll get my money back. It's just that I'll pay shipping to ship them back if I don't sell them. So I get two different stories. I don't think the independent guy had anything to, any reason to lie, but I do believe that the bosses at Barnes & Noble told their people that stop ordering print on demand and indie stuff. So, you know, you order the traditional published stuff. So they're still there, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, I don't see how I can get my book into Barnes & Noble unless I'm signed by one of them.
You know, the secret really is going on tour. The authors that go on tour and go to all the bookstores and do all these signings do really well because each store, because each time, like I did two in the summer, four in the summer, and you sell, I don't know, 20 to 50 books each signing. Mm. And you do that, you know, over 6-8 signings, you're starting to sell books and in different regions, and all those stores will keep ordering your books. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You just got to break the seal kind of thing.
You got to break it and go to a suburb of the closest city to you and hit a smaller Barnes & Nobles and maybe an independent bookstore. You got to get some sort of break in and
Exactly. And you got to spend time doing what you're doing and you get better at it by, you know, trial and error. And I'm old enough to know that. I'm just exhausted thinking about it.
just focus. There's so much to it, and you just focus on what you can. Get out there, do the best you can today, and try not to think of, you know, anything else, and try not to get, you know, sidelined with stuff. Just kind of go, well, I want to get a book signing done. Where can I do it? And focus on that. Figure that out. Because there are places that will do it. Especially if, let's say, someone does say it's an independent bookstore, and they go, we don't like to have signings with print on demand. Just say you're going to bring your own books. Or that you guarantee, you'll take returns. Because it'll come, you can print them on demand yourself. You can pay for Ingram and order 50 books and pay cost and take them in with you. And that's what a lot of authors do for shows, right?
I guess, yeah. Yeah, actually, I think they did that at the Merrimack Valley Halloween Book Festival.
Well, if we're going to do a show here, that's what I would do. If a publisher's involved, a lot of times they'll do it for you. They'll print up. See, and that's kind of an advantage. If your publisher prints the books and sends them, then sometimes you can get in other stores that just print on demand.
That's part of what I'm learning. Just like, a little bit of a roadblock here and there, whatever.
Let's talk about how people find Michael Clark. Like, where are you on social media? You have websites. Where do people find him?
I can't try to keep it simple. My website is michaelclarkbooks.com, and that's Clark with no E. And I am Mike Clark Books on Twitter, and pretty much Michael Clark Books everywhere else.
Fantastic. Of course, now we're going to have that up on our website as well. People can find you with one click, so we're all set. Again, your new book is called Hell on High, and our guest is the author, Michael Clark. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Michael.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.